group rewards. Evidence that might contradict a belief we hold is no longer viewed through as hurtful a frame. Rather, it is viewed as helpful because it can improve our chances of making a better bet. And winning a bet triggers a reinforcing positive update. Accountability, like reinforcement of accuracy, also improves our decision-making and information processing when we are away from the group, because we know in advance that we will have to answer to the group for our decisions. Early in my poker career, my poker group recommended that a way to avoid the effects of self-serving bias when I was losing was to have a preset loss limit. If I lost $600 at the stakes I was playing, I would leave the game. The smart, experienced players advising me knew that in the moment of losing, I might not be my most rational self in assessing whether I was losing because I was getting unlucky or losing because I was playing poorly. A predetermined loss limit acts as a check against irrationally chasing losses. But self-enforcement is a problem. If you have more money in your pocket, you might still take it out. If you're out of money, casinos have ATMs and machines that let you get cash advances on your credit cards. Poker players are also pretty liberal about lending money to losing players. I was much less likely to break a loss limit because I knew I was accountable to my pod. If I reached my loss limit and my inner voice said, "This game is so good, I should put up more money and keep playing," it also reminded me I'd have to answer for the decision to a group of players I respected. Accountability made me run that conversation in my head, in which I started explaining how I was just getting unlucky, and they would expose why I was likely biased in my assessment, helping me resist the urge to buy more chips. And, after leaving a losing game and going home, I could offset some of the sting of losing by running the conversation where my pod would approve of my decision to quit the game when I told them about it. Imagining how the discussion will go helps us spot more errors on our own and catch them more quickly. The group ideally exposes us to a diversity of viewpoints. John Stuart Mill is one of the heroes of thinking in bets. More than 150 years after writing On Liberty, his thinking on social and political philosophy remains startlingly current. One of the frequent themes in On Liberty is the importance of diversity of opinion. Diversity and dissent are not only checks on fallibility, but the only means of testing the ultimate truth of an opinion. Quote, "The only way in which a human being can make some approach to knowing the whole of a subject is by hearing what can be said about it by persons of every variety of opinion, and studying all modes in which it can be looked at by every character of mind. No wise man ever acquired his wisdom in any mode but this. Nor is it in the nature of human intellect to become wise in any other manner." End quote. There is a simple beauty in Mill's insight. On our own, we have just one viewpoint. That's our limitation as humans. But if we take a bunch of people with that limitation and put them together in a group, we get exposed to diverse opinions, can test alternative hypotheses, and move toward accuracy. It is almost impossible for us on our own to get the diversity of viewpoints provided by the combined manpower of a well-formed decision pod. To get a more objective view of the world, we need an environment that exposes us to alternate hypotheses and different perspectives. That doesn't apply only to the world around us. To view ourselves in a more realistic way, we need other people to fill in our blind spots. A group with diverse viewpoints can help us by sharing the work suggested in the previous two chapters to combat motivated reasoning about beliefs and biased outcome fielding. When we think in bets, we run through a series of questions to examine the accuracy of our beliefs. For example, why might my belief not be true? What other evidence might be out there bearing on my belief? Are there similar areas I can look toward to gauge whether similar beliefs to mine are true? What sources of information could I have missed or minimized on the way to reaching my belief? What are the reasons someone else could have a different belief? What's their support? And why might they be right instead of me? What other perspectives are there as to why things turned out the way they did? Just by asking ourselves these questions, we are taking a big step toward calibration. But there is only so much we can do to answer these questions on our own. We only get exposed to the information we have been exposed to, only live the experiences we have experienced, only think of the hypotheses that we can conceive of. It's hard to know what reason someone else could have for believing something different. We aren't them. We haven't had their experiences. We don't know what different information they have. But they do. Much of our biased information processing stems from the amount of rope that uncertainty affords us. Well-deployed diversity of viewpoints in a group can reduce uncertainty due to incomplete information by filling in the gaps in what we know, making life start to fit more neatly on a chessboard. Others aren't wrapped up in preserving our narrative, anchored by our biases. It is a lot easier to have someone else offer their perspective than for you to imagine you're another person and think about what their perspective might be. A diverse group can do some of the heavy lifting of debiasing for us. A poker table is a naturally diverse setting because we generally don't select who we play with for their opinions. Even better, when there is disagreement stemming from the diverse opinions represented at a poker table, the discussion may naturally progress toward betting on it. These are ideal circumstances for promoting accuracy. Numerous groups have recognized the need to engineer the kind of diversity and encouragement of dissent that naturally occurs at a poker table. The State Department, since the Vietnam War, has had a formal dissent channel where employees can have their dissenting views heard and addressed without fear of penalty. The American Foreign Service Association, the professional organization of foreign service employees, has four separate awards it gives annually to members to recognize and encourage constructive dissent and risk-taking in the Foreign Service. The dissent channel has been credited with a policy change that helped end the genocidal war in Bosnia. In June 2016, 51 State Department employees signed a memo calling for President Obama to strengthen American military efforts in Syria. In late January 2017, approximately 1,000 employees signed a dissent cable in response to President Trump's executive order suspending immigration from 7 Muslim-majority countries. The dissent channel represents something hopeful in our nation's decision-making process. In an environment of increased polarization, Foreign Service employees can make their voices heard about policies with which they disagree, and do it regardless of whether the administration is Democrat or Republican. Allowing dissent has a value that transcends party politics. After 9/11, the CIA created red teams that, according to Georgetown Law professor Neil Katyal in a New York Times op-ed, are dedicated to arguing against the intelligence community's conventional wisdom and spotting flaws in logic and analysis. Senior Obama administration officials, following the raid that killed Osama bin Laden, mentioned red team analysis among the methods used to measure the degree of confidence that bin Laden, in the absence of visual or auditory confirmation, was in the compound subject to the raid. Dissent channels and red teams are beautiful implementations of Mill's bedrock principle that we can't know the truth of a matter without hearing the other side. This commitment to diversity of opinion is something that we would be wise to apply to our own decision groups. For example, if a corporate strategy group is figuring out how to integrate operations following a merger, someone who initially opposed the merger would be good to have as part of that group. Perhaps they have reasons why the two sales departments won't mesh. Whatever their reasons, they could help the majority move forward with a wiser approach by taking those reasons into account. Diversity is the foundation of productive group decision-making, but we can't underestimate how hard it is to maintain. We all tend to gravitate toward people who are near clones of us. After all, it feels good to hear our ideas echoed back to us. If there is any doubt how easy it can be to fall into this confirmatory drift, we can even see this tendency in groups we consider some of the most dedicated to truth-seeking, judges and scientists. Federal judges, drift happens. Cass Sunstein, now a Harvard law professor, conducted a massive study with colleagues when he was on the faculty of the University of Chicago Law School on ideological diversity in federal judicial panels. Sunstein recognized at the outset that the U.S. Court of Appeals are, quote, an extraordinary and long-standing natural experiment, end quote, in diversity. Appellate court panels are composed of three judges randomly drawn from that circuit's pool. Each circuit's pool includes life-tenured judges chosen when an opening occurs or Congress recognizes the need for additional judges by the sitting president. In any particular appeal, you could get a panel of three Democrat appointees, three Republican appointees, or a 2-to-1 mix in either direction. The study, encompassing over 6,000 federal appeals and nearly 20,000 individual votes, found, not surprisingly, that judicial voting generally followed political lines. Pure, unaided open-mindedness, even by life-tenured judges sworn to uphold the law, is hard. When there was political diversity on the panels, the researchers found several areas where that diversity improved the panel's work. Even though, in most cases, two politically similar judges could dictate the panel's outcome, there were significant differences between heterogeneous and homogeneous panels. A single panelist from the other party had, quote, a large disciplining effect, end quote. They found, for example, quote, strong evidence of ideological dampening, end quote, in environmental cases. Democrat appointees who overall voted for plaintiffs 43% of the time voted for plaintiffs just 10% of the time when sitting with two Republican appointees. Republican appointees, who overall voted for plaintiffs 20% of the time, voted for plaintiffs 42% of the time when seated with two Democrat appointees. This held up across most of the 25 categories of cases in which they had a sufficiently large sample size to reach a conclusion. The authors concluded that the result endorsed the importance of exposure to diverse viewpoints. Quote, what is necessary is reasonable diversity, or diversity of reasonable views, and that it is important to ensure that judges no less than anyone else are exposed to it, and not merely through the arguments of advocates, end quote. Sunstein's group found that federal appellate judges need the diverse viewpoint of an opposing party appointee. Judges, they found, followed the human instinct of succumbing to groupthink. Our data provides strong evidence that like-minded judges also go to extremes. The probability that a judge will vote in one or another direction is greatly increased by the presence of judges appointed by the president of the same political party. In short, we claim to show both strong conformity effects and group polarization within federal courts of appeals. The growing polarization of the Supreme Court is a case in point. Each justice now has four clerks, all of whom have similar credentials, top-of-the-class graduates of top law schools, law review editors, and clerkships with federal appeals court judges. The clerks, over the years, have played an increasingly important role in helping the justices with their intellectual workload, discussing details of cases, and drafting initial versions of opinions. Prior to the appointment of Chief Justice Roberts in 2005, it was an informal badge of honor, especially among some of the conservative members of the court, that they hired clerks with ideological backgrounds that differed from theirs. Bob Woodward and Scott Armstrong, in The Brethren, described how Justice Powell, quote, prided himself on hiring liberal clerks. He would tell his clerks that the conservative side of the issues came to him naturally. Their job was to present the other side, to challenge him. He would rather encounter a compelling argument for another position in the privacy of his own chambers than to meet it unexpectedly at conference or in a dissent, end quote. Chief Justice Berger hired equally from the ranks of former clerks of Democrat and Republican-appointed judges. Chief Justice Rehnquist, who served on the court with Berger and succeeded him, arrived at the court suspicious of the role liberal clerks could have in influencing his opinion. According to The Brethren, however, that attitude disappeared almost immediately. Rehnquist believed, quote, the legal and moral interchanges that liberal clerks thrived on were good for the justices and for the court, end quote. Justice Scalia, when he served on the D.C. Circuit and in his early years on the Supreme Court, was known for seeking out clerks with liberal ideologies. As the Supreme Court has become more divided, this practice has all but ceased. According to a New York Times article in 2010, only Justice Breyer regularly employed clerks who had worked for circuit judges appointed by presidents of both parties. Since 2005, Scalia had hired no clerks with experience working for Democrat-appointed judges. In light of the shift in hiring practices, it should not be so surprising that the court has become more polarized. The justices are in the process of creating their own echo chambers. Justice Thomas, from 1986 to the time the article was written, was 84 for 84 in hiring clerks who had worked for Republican-appointed judges. Not surprisingly, according to data compiled from the Journal of Law, Economics, and Organization, he is the justice furthest from the ideological center of the court, much further right than the most liberal-leaning justice, Sotomayor, is left. Thomas once said, I won't hire clerks who have profound disagreements with me. It's like trying to train a pig. It wastes your time, and it aggravates the pig. That makes sense only if you believe the goal of a decision group is to train people to agree with you. But if your goal is to develop the best decision process, that is an odd sentiment indeed. This polarization warns against forming a decision group that is a collection of clones who share the same opinions and knowledge sources we do. The more homogeneous we get, the more the group will promote and amplify confirmatory thought. Sadly, that's exactly what we drift toward. Even Supreme Court justices do that. We are all familiar with this tendency in politics. It's the complaint on both sides of the political aisle. Conservatives complain that liberals live in an echo chamber where they just repeat and confirm their point of view. They aren't open to new information or ideas that don't fit what they already believe. That's the exact same criticism liberals have of conservatives. Although the internet and the breadth of multimedia news outlets provide us with limitless access to diverse opinions, they also give us an unprecedented opportunity to descend into a bubble. Getting our information from sources we know will share our view of the world. We often don't even realize when we are in the echo chamber ourselves because we're so in love with our own ideas that it all just sounds sensible and right. In political discourse, virtually everyone, even those familiar with groupthink, will assert, I'm the rational group exchanging ideas and thinking these things through. The people on the other side, though, they're in an echo chamber. We must be vigilant about this drift in our groups and be prepared to fight it. Whether it is in the forming of a group of friends or a pod at work, or hiring for diversity of viewpoint and tolerance for dissent when you are able to guide an enterprise's culture toward accuracy, we should guard against gravitating toward clones of ourselves. We should also recognize that it's really hard. The norm is toward homogeneity. We're all guilty of it, and we don't even notice we're doing it. Social psychologists, confirmatory drift, and heterodox academy. In 2011, John Haidt, speaking to an audience of 1,000 social psychologists, noted the lack of viewpoint diversity in their field. He reported that he could identify only one conservative social psychologist with any degree of field-wide recognition. Surveys of sociologists' professional organizations have found that 85% to 96% of the members responding self-identified as left of center, voted for Obama in 2012, or scored left of center on a questionnaire of political views. Most of the remaining 4% to 15% identified as centrist or moderate rather than conservative. The trend has a long tail, but it has been accelerating. In the 1990s, liberals among social psychologists outnumbered conservatives 4-1. More recent surveys show that the ratio has grown to greater than 10-1, sometimes far greater. A tendency to hire for a conforming worldview, combined with the discouraging aspects of being so decisively outnumbered ideologically, suggests that, unchecked, this situation won't get better. According to the surveys establishing this trend toward homogeneity, about 10% of faculty respondents identified as conservative, compared with just 2% of grad students and postdoctoral candidates. Height, along with Philip Tetlock and four others, social psychologists Jose Duarte, Jarrett Crawford, and Lee Jessam, and sociologist Charlotta Stern, founded an organization called Heterodox Academy to fight this drift toward homogeneity of thought in science and academics as a whole. In 2015, they published their findings in the Journal of Behavioral and Brain Sciences, along with 33 pieces of open peer commentary. The BBS paper explained and documented the political imbalance in social psychology, how it reduces the quality of science, and what can be done to improve the situation. Social psychology is particularly vulnerable to the effects of political imbalance. Social psychologists are researching many of the hot-button issues dividing the political left and right: racism, sexism, stereotypes, and responses to power and authority. Coming from a community composed almost entirely of liberal-leaning scientists, the quality and impact of research can suffer. The authors identified instances in which political values became, quote, embedded into research questions in ways that make some constructs unobservable and unmeasurable, thereby invalidating attempts at hypothesis testing, end quote. This occurred in several experiments involving attitudes on environmental issues and attempts to link ideology to unethical behavior. They also identified the risk of researchers concentrating on topics that validated their shared narrative and avoiding topics that contested that narrative, such as stereotype accuracy and the scope and direction of prejudice. Finally, they pointed to the obvious problem inherent in the legitimacy of research characterizing conservatives as dogmatic and intolerant, done by a discipline that is over 10-to-1 liberal-leaning. First, the Heterodox Academy effort shows that there is a natural drift toward homogeneity and confirmatory thought. We all experience this gravitation toward people who think like we do. Scientists, overwhelmingly trained and chartered toward truth-seeking, aren't immune. As the authors of the BBS paper recognized, quote, even research communities of highly intelligent and well-meaning individuals can fall prey to confirmation bias, as IQ is positively correlated with the number of reasons people find to support their own side in an argument, end quote. That's how robust these biases are. We see that even judges and scientists succumb to these biases. We shouldn't feel bad, whatever our situation, about admitting that we also need help. Second, groups with diverse viewpoints are the best protection against confirmatory thought. Peer review, the gold standard that epitomizes the open-mindedness and hypothesis testing of the scientific method, quote, offers much less protection against error when the community of peers is politically homogeneous, end quote. In other words, the opinions of the group members aren't much help if it is a group of clones. Experimental studies cited in the BBS paper found that confirmation bias led reviewers, quote, to work extra hard to find flaws with papers whose conclusions they dislike, and to be more permissive about methodological issues when they endorse the conclusions, end quote. The authors of the BBS paper concluded that nobody has found a way to eradicate confirmation bias in individuals, but we can diversify the field to the point where individual viewpoint biases begin to cancel each other out. The BBS paper and the continuing work of Heterodox Academy includes specific recommendations geared toward encouraging diversity and dissenting opinions. I encourage you to read the specific recommendations, which include things like a stated anti-discrimination policy against opposing viewpoints, developing ways to encourage people with contrary viewpoints to join the group and engage in the process, and surveying to gauge the actual heterogeneity or homogeneity of opinion in the group. These are exactly the kinds of things we would do well to adopt, and where necessary, adapt, for groups in our personal lives and in the workplace. Even among those who are committed to truth-seeking, judges and academics, we can see how strong the tendency is to seek out confirmation of our beliefs. If you have any doubt this is true for all of us, put this book down for a moment and check your Twitter feed for whom you follow. It's a pretty safe bet that the bulk of them are ideologically aligned with you. If that's the case, start following some people from the other side of the aisle. Want to bet on science? If thinking in bets helps debias us, couldn't we apply it to help solve the heterodox academy problem? One might guess that scientists would be more accurate if they had to bet on the likelihood that results would replicate as compared to traditional peer review, which can be vulnerable to viewpoint bias. Especially in an anonymous betting market, confirming the strength of your pre-existing ideology or betting solely on the basis that replication of a study confirms your own work or beliefs counts for nothing. The way a scientist would be right in such a betting market is by using their skill in a superior way to make the most objective bets on whether results would or would not replicate. Researchers who knew in advance their work would be subject to a market test would also face an additional form of accountability that would likely modulate their reporting of results. At least one study has found that, yes, a betting market where scientists wager on the likelihood of experimental results replicating was more accurate than expert opinion alone. In psychology, there has been a controversy over the last decade about a potentially large number of published studies with results subsequent researchers could not replicate. The Reproducibility Project, Psychology, has been working on replicating studies from top psychology journals. Anna Dreber, a behavioral economist at the Stockholm School of Economics, along with several colleagues, set up a betting market based on these replication attempts. They recruited a bunch of experts in the relevant fields and asked their opinions on the likelihood the Reproducibility Project would replicate the results of 44 studies. They then gave those same experts money to bet on each study's replication in a prediction market. Experts engaging in traditional peer review, providing their opinion on whether an experimental result would replicate, were right 58% of the time. A betting market in which the traders were the exact same experts, and those experts had money on the line, predicted correctly 71% of the time. A lot of people were surprised to learn that the expert opinion expressed as a bet was more accurate than expert opinion expressed through peer review, since peer review is considered a rock-solid foundation of the scientific method. Of course, this result shouldn't be surprising to readers of this book. We know that scientists are dedicated to truth-seeking and take peer review seriously. Arguably, there is already an implied betting element in the scientific process, in that researchers and peer reviewers have a reputational stake in the quality of their review. But we know that scientists, like judges and like us, are human and subject to these patterns of confirmatory thought. Making the risk explicit rather than implicit refocuses us all to be more objective. A growing number of businesses are, in fact, implementing betting markets to solve for the difficulties in getting and encouraging contrary opinions. Companies implementing prediction markets to test decisions include Google, Microsoft, General Electric, Eli Lilly, Pfizer, and Siemens. People are more willing to offer their opinion when the goal is to win a bet rather than get along with the people in a room. Accuracy, accountability, and diversity wrapped into a group's charter all contribute to better decision-making, especially if the group promotes thinking in bets. Now that we understand the elements of a good charter, we move on to the rules of engagement for a production decision group. How to most effectively communicate with one another. A pioneering sociologist actually designed a set of truth-seeking norms for a group, scientists, that form a pretty good blueprint for engagement. I don't know if he was a better, but he was influenced by something very relevant to thinking about bias, rationality, and the potential gulf between perception and reality. He was a magician. Chapter 5. Descent to Win. Kudos to a magician. Meyer R. Skolnick was born on the 4th of July, 1910, in South Philadelphia. He performed magic at birthday parties as a teenager and considered a career as a performer. He adopted the performing name Robert Merlin. Then a friend convinced him that a teen magician naming himself after Merlin was too on the nose, so he performed as Robert Merton. When Robert K. Merton, to distinguish him from his son, economist and Nobel laureate Robert C. Merton, died in 2003, The New York Times called him, quote, one of the most influential sociologists of the 20th century, end quote. The founders of Heterodox Academy in the BBS paper specifically recognized Merton's 1942 and 1973 papers in which he established norms for the scientific community known by the acronym KUDOS, quote, an ideologically balanced science that routinely resorted to adversarial collaborations to resolve empirical disputes would bear a striking resemblance to Robert Merton's ideal type model of a self-correcting epistemic community, one organized around the norms of KUDOS, end quote. Per the BBS paper, KUDOS stands for C, communism, data belong to the group, U, universalism, apply uniform standards to claims and evidence, regardless of where they came from. D, disinterestedness, vigilance against potential conflicts that can influence the group's evaluation. And OS, organized skepticism, discussion among the group to encourage engagement and dissent. If you want to pick a role model for designing a group's practical rules of engagement, you can't do better than Merton. To start, he coined the phrase role model, along with self-fulfilling prophecy, reference group, unintended consequences, and focus group. He founded the science of sociology and was the first sociologist awarded the National Medal of Science. Merton began his academic career in the 1930s, studying the history of institutional influences on the scientific community. To him, it was a story of many periods of scientific advancement, spurred on by geopolitical influences, but also periods of struggle to maintain independence from those influences. His life spanned both world wars and the Cold War, in which he studied and witnessed nationalist movements in which people, quote, arrayed their political selves in the garb of scientists, end quote, explicitly evaluating scientific knowledge based on political and national affiliations. In 1942, Merton wrote about the normative structure of science. He tinkered with the paper over the next 31 years, publishing the final version as part of a book in 1973. This 12-page paper is an excellent manual for developing rules of engagement for any truth-seeking group. I recognized its application to my poker group and professional and workplace groups I've encountered in speaking and consulting. Each element of KUDOS, communism, universalism, disinterestedness, and organized skepticism, can be broadly applied and adapted to push a group toward objectivity. When there is a drift toward confirmation and away from exploring accuracy, it's likely the result of the failure to nurture one of Merton's norms. Not surprisingly, Merton's paper would make an excellent career guide for anyone seeking to be a profitable better or a profitable decision maker, period. Mertonian communism. More is more. The Mertonian norm of communism, obviously not the political system, refers to the communal ownership of data within groups. Merton argued that in academics, an individual researcher's data must eventually be shared with the scientific community at large for knowledge to advance. Merton said, secrecy is the antithesis of this norm. Full and open communication, its enactment. In science, this means that the community has an agreement that research results cannot be properly reviewed without access to the data and a detailed description of the experimental design and methods. Researchers are entitled to keep data private until published, but once they accomplish that, they should throw the doors open to give the community every opportunity to make a proper assessment. Any attempt at accuracy is bound to fall short if the truth-seeking group has only limited access to potentially pertinent information. Without all the facts, accuracy suffers. This ideal of scientific sharing was similarly described by physicist Richard Feynman in a 1974 lecture as, quote, a kind of utter honesty, a kind of leaning over backwards. For example, if you're doing an experiment, you should report everything that you think might make it invalid, not only what you think is right about it, other causes that could possibly explain your results, end quote. It is unrealistic to think we can perfectly achieve Feynman's ideal. Even scientists struggle with it. Within our own decision pod, we should strive to abide by the rule that more is more. Get all the information out there, Indulge the broadest definition of what could conceivably be relevant. Reward the process of pulling the skeletons of our own reasoning out of the closet. As a rule of thumb, if we have an urge to leave out a detail because it makes us uncomfortable or requires even more clarification to explain away, those are exactly the details we must share. The mere fact of our hesitation and discomfort is a signal that such information may be critical to providing a complete and balanced account. Likewise, as members of a group evaluating a decision, we should take such hesitation as a signal to explore further. To the extent we regard self-governance in the United States as a truth-seeking experiment, we have established that openness in the sharing of information is a cornerstone of making and accounting for decisions by the government. The free press and free speech guarantees of the Constitution recognize the importance of self-expression, but they also exist because we need mechanisms to assure that information makes it to the public. The government serves the people, so the people own the data and have a right to have the data shared with them. Statutes like the Freedom of Information Act have the same purpose. Without free access to information, it is impossible to make reasoned assessments of our government. Sharing data and information, like the other elements of a truth-seeking charter, is done by agreement. Academics agree to share results. The government shares information by agreement with the people. Without an agreement, we can't and shouldn't compel others to share information they don't want to share. We all have a right of privacy. Companies and other entities have rights to trade secrets and to protect their intellectual property. But within our group, an agreement to share details pertinent to assessing the quality of a decision is part of a productive truth-seeking charter. If the group is discussing a decision and it doesn't have all the details, it might be because the person providing them doesn't realize the relevance of some of the data. Or it could mean the person telling the story has a bias toward encouraging a certain narrative that they likely aren't even aware of. After all, as Jonathan Haidt points out, we are all our own best PR agents, spinning a narrative that shines the most flattering light on us. We have all experienced situations where we get two accounts of the same event, but the versions are dramatically different because they are informed by different facts and perspectives. This is known as the Rashomon effect, named for the 1950s cinematic classic Rashomon, directed by Akira Kurosawa. The central element of the otherwise simple plot was how incompleteness is a tool for bias. In the film, four people give separate, drastically different accounts of a scene they all observed. The seduction or rape of a woman by a bandit. The bandit's duel with her husband, if there was a duel. And the husband's death, from losing the duel, murder, or suicide. Even without the conflicting versions, the Rashomon effect reminds us that we can't assume one version of a story is accurate or complete. We can't count on someone else to provide the other side of the story, or any individual's version to provide a full and objective accounting of all the relevant information. That's why, within a decision group, it is helpful to commit to this Mertonian norm on both sides of the discussion. When presenting a decision for discussion, we should be mindful of details we might be omitting, and be extra safe by adding anything that could possibly be relevant. On the evaluation side, we must query each other to extract those details when necessary. My consultation with the CEO who traced his company's problems to firing the president demonstrated the value of a commitment to data sharing. After he described what happened, I requested a lot more information. As he got into details of the hiring process for that executive, and approaches to dealing with the president's deficiencies on the job, that led to further questions about those decisions, which in turn led to more details being shared. He was identifying what he thought was a bad decision, justified by his initial description of the situation. After we got every detail out of all the dimensions of the decision, we reached a different conclusion. The decision to fire the president had been quite reasonable strategically. It just happened to turn out badly. Be a data sharer. That's what experts do. In fact, that's one of the reasons experts become experts. They understand that sharing data is the best way to move toward accuracy because it extracts insights from your listeners of the highest fidelity. You should hear the amount of detail a top poker player puts into the description of a hand when they are workshopping that hand with another player. A layperson would think, that seems like a lot of irrelevant nitpicky detail. Why are they saying all that stuff? When two expert poker players get together to trade views and opinions about hands, the detail is extraordinary. The positions of everyone acting in the hand, the size of the bets, and the size of the pot after each action, what they know about how their opponent has played when they have encountered them in the past, how they were playing in the particular game they were in, how they were playing in the most recent hands in that game, particularly whether they were winning or losing recently, how many chips each person had throughout the hand, what their opponents know about them, etc., etc. What the experts recognize is that the more detail you provide, the better the assessment of decision quality you get. And because the same types of details are always expected, expert players essentially work from a template, so there is less opportunity to convey only the information that might lead the listener down a garden path to a desired conclusion. Hall of Fame football coach John Madden, in a documentary about Vince Lombardi, told a story about how, as a young assistant coach, he attended a coaching clinic where Lombardi spoke about one play, the power sweep, a running play that he made famous with the Green Bay Packers in the 1960s. Lombardi held the audience spellbound as he described that one play for 8 hours. Madden said, "I went there cocky, thinking I knew everything there was to know about football. And he spent 8 hours talking about this one play. I realized then that I actually knew nothing about football." We are naturally reluctant to share information that could encourage others to find fault in our decision-making. My group made this easier by making me feel good about committing myself to improvement. When I shared details that cast me in what I perceived to be a bad light, I got a positive self-image update from the approval of players I respected. In my consulting, I've encouraged companies to make sure they don't define winning solely by results or providing a self-enhancing narrative. If part of corporate success consists of providing the most accurate, objective, and detailed evaluation of what's going on, employees will compete to win on those terms. That will reward better habits of mind. Agree to be a data sharer and reward others in your decision group for telling more of their story. Universalism. Don't shoot the message. The well-known advice, "don't shoot the messenger," is actually good shorthand for the reasons why we want to protect and encourage dissenting ideas. Plutarch provided an early, literal example. The king of Armenia got advance notice that troops were approaching. He killed the messenger for delivering that message, and henceforth, messengers stopped reporting such intelligence. Obviously, if you don't like the message, you shouldn't take it out on the messenger. The Mertonian norm of universalism is the converse. Quote, "Truth claims, whatever their source, are to be subjected to pre-established impersonal criteria," end quote. It means acceptance or rejection of an idea must not, quote, "depend on the personal or social attributes of their protagonist," end quote. Don't shoot the message, for some reason, hasn't gotten the same historical or literary attention, but it addresses an equally important decision-making issue. Don't disparage or ignore an idea just because you don't like who or where it came from. When we have a negative opinion about the person delivering the message, we close our minds to what they are saying and miss a lot of learning opportunities because of it. Likewise, when we have a positive opinion of the messenger, we tend to accept the message without much vetting. Both are bad. Whether the situation involves facts, ideas, beliefs, opinions, or predictions, the substance of the information has merit, or lack of merit, separate from where it came from. If you're deciding the truth of whether the earth is round, it doesn't matter if the idea came from your best friend, or George Washington, or Benito Mussolini. The accuracy of that statement should be evaluated, independent of its source. I learned an early lesson in my poker career about universalism. I started playing poker using that list of hands my brother Howard wrote on a napkin. I treated this initial advice like a holy document. Therefore, when I saw someone playing hands off list, I immediately labeled them as a bad player. When I saw such a player subsequently execute a strategy I didn't have as part of my game, I dismissed it. Doing that across the board, especially when I was labeling these players as bad based on one view of a sound beginner strategy, was an expensive lesson in universalism. For so many things going on at the table in the first years of my poker career, I shot the message. I was guilty of the same thing David Letterman admitted in his explanation to Lauren Conrad. He spent a long time assuming people around him were idiots before considering the alternative hypothesis. Maybe I'm the idiot. In poker, I was the idiot. As I learned that Howard's List was just a safe way to get me started, and not the Magna Carta scrawled in crayon on a napkin, I developed an exercise to practice and reinforce universalism. When I had the impulse to dismiss someone as a bad player, I made myself find something they did well. It was an exercise I could do for myself, and I could get help from my group in analyzing the strategies I thought those players might be executing well. That commitment led to many benefits. Of course, I learned some new and profitable strategies and tactics. I also developed a more complete picture of other players' strategies. Even when I determined that the strategic choices of the player weren't, in the end, profitable, I had a deeper understanding of my opponent's game, which helped me devise counter-strategies. I had started thinking more deeply about the way my opponents thought, and in some instances, I recognized that I had underestimated the skills of certain players who I initially thought were profitable for me to play against. That led me to make more objective decisions about game selection. And my poker group benefited from this exercise as well because in workshopping the strategies with each other, we multiplied the number of playing techniques we could observe and discuss. Admitting that the people I played against had things to teach me was hard, and my group helped me feel proud of myself when I resisted the urge to just complain about how lucky my opponents were. Nearly any group can create an exercise to develop and reinforce the open-mindedness universalism requires. As an example, with politics so polarized, we forget the obvious truth that no one has only good ideas or only bad ideas. Liberals would do well to take some time to read and watch more conservative news sources, and conservatives would do well to take some time to read and watch more liberal news sources, not with the goal of confirming that the other side is a collection of idiots who have nothing of value to say, but to specifically and purposely find things they agree with. When we do this, we learn things we wouldn't otherwise have learned. Our views will likely become moderated in the same way judges from opposite sides of the political aisle moderate each other. Even if in the end, we don't find much to agree with, we will understand the opposing position better, and ours as well. We'll be practicing what John Stuart Mill preached. Another way to disentangle the message from the messenger is to imagine the message coming from a source we value much more or much less. If we hear an account from someone we like, imagine if someone we didn't like told us the same story, and vice versa. This can be incorporated into an exploratory group's work, asking each other, how would we feel about this if we heard it from a much different source? We can take this process of vetting information in the group further, initially and intentionally omitting where or whom we heard the idea from. Leading off our story by identifying the messenger could interfere with the group's commitment to universalism, biasing them to agree with or discredit the message depending on their opinion of the messenger. So leave the source out to start, giving the group the maximum opportunity to form an impression without shooting or celebrating the message based on their opinion of the messenger, separate from the expertise and credibility of the messenger. John Stuart Mill made it clear that the only way to gain knowledge and approach truth is by examining every variety of opinion. We learn things we didn't know. We calibrate better. Even when the result of that examination confirms our initial position, we understand that position better if we open ourselves to every side of the issue. That requires open-mindedness to the messages that come from places we don't like. Disinterestedness. We all have a conflict of interest, and it's contagious. Back in the 1960s, the scientific community was at odds about whether sugar or fat was the culprit in the increasing rates of heart disease. In 1967, three Harvard scientists conducted a comprehensive review of the research to date, published in the New England Journal of Medicine, that firmly pointed the finger at fat as the culprit. The paper was, not surprisingly, influential in the debate on diet and heart disease. After all, the NEJM is and was a prestigious publication, and the researchers were all three from Harvard. Blaming fat and exonerating sugar affected the diets of hundreds of millions of people for decades, a belief that caused a shift in eating habits that has been linked to the massive increase in obesity rates and diabetes. The influence of this paper and its negative effects on America's eating habits and health provides a stunning demonstration of the imperative of disinterestedness. It was recently discovered that a trade group representing the sugar industry had paid the three Harvard scientists to write the paper, according to an article published in JAMA, Internal Medicine, in September 2016. Not surprisingly, consistent with the agenda of the sugar industry that had paid them, the researchers attacked the methodology of studies finding a link between sugar and heart disease and defended studies finding no link. The scientists' attack on and defenses of the methodology of studies on fat and heart disease followed the same pro-sugar pattern. The scientists involved are all dead. Were they alive, it's possible, if we could ask them, that they may not have even consciously known they were being influenced. Given human nature, they likely, at least, would have defended the truth of what they wrote and denied that the sugar industry dictated or influenced their thinking on the subject. Regardless, had the conflict of interest been disclosed, the scientific community would have viewed their conclusions with much more skepticism, taking into account the possibility of bias due to the researcher's financial interest. At the time, the NEJM did not require any such disclosures. That policy changed in 1984. That omission prevented an accurate assessment of the findings, resulting in serious harm to the health of the nation. We tend to think about conflicts of interest in the financial sense, like the researchers getting paid by the sugar industry. But conflicts of interest come in many flavors. Our brains have built-in conflicts of interest, interpreting the world around us to confirm our beliefs, to avoid having to admit ignorance or error, to take credit for good results following our decisions, to find reasons bad results following our decisions were due to factors outside our control, to compare well with our peers, and to live in a world where the way things turn out makes sense. We are not naturally disinterested. We don't process information independent of the way we wish the world to be. Remember the thought experiment I suggested at the beginning of the book about what the headlines would have looked like if Pete Carroll's Pascal had won the 2015 Super Bowl? Those headlines would have been about his brilliance. People would have analyzed Carroll's decision differently. Knowing how something turned out creates a conflict of interest that expresses itself as resulting. Richard Feynman recognized that in physics, a branch of science that most of us consider as objective as 2 plus 2 equals 4, there is still demonstrable outcome bias. He found that if those analyzing data knew, or could even just intuit, the hypothesis being tested, the analysis would be more likely to support the hypothesis being tested. The measurements might be objective, but slicing and dicing the data is vulnerable to bias, even unconsciously. According to Robert McCoon and physics Nobel laureate Saul Perlmutter in a 2015 Nature article, outcome-blind analysis has spread to several areas of particle physics and cosmology, where it, quote, is often considered the only way to trust many results, end quote. Because the idea, introducing a random variable so that those analyzing the data could not surmise the outcome the research might be hoping for, is hardly known in biological, psychological, and social sciences, the authors concluded these methods, quote, might improve trust and integrity in many sciences, including those with high-stakes analyses that are easily plagued by bias, end quote. Outcome blindness enforces disinterestedness. We can apply this idea of outcome blindness to the way we communicate information as we workshop decisions about our far more ambiguous pursuits, like describing a poker hand or a family argument or the results of a market test for a new product. If the group is going to help us make and evaluate decisions in an unbiased way, We don't want to infect them in the way the data analysts were infected if they could surmise the hypothesis being tested. Telling someone how a story ends encourages them to be resulters, to interpret the details to fit that outcome. If I won a hand, it was more likely my group would assess my strategy as good. If I lost a hand, the reverse would be true. Win a case at trial, the strategy is brilliant. Lose, and mistakes were made. We treat outcomes as good signals for decision quality, as if we were playing chess. If the outcome is known, it will bias the assessment of the decision quality to align with the outcome quality. If the group is blind to the outcome, it produces higher fidelity evaluation of decision quality. The best way to do this is to deconstruct decisions before an outcome is known. Attorneys can evaluate trial strategy before the verdict comes in. Sales teams can evaluate strategy before learning whether they've closed the sale. Traders can vet process prior to positions being established or prior to options expiring. After the outcome, make it a habit when seeking advice to give the details without revealing the outcome. In poker, it isn't practical to analyze hands before knowing how they turn out, since the results come within seconds of the decisions. To address this, many expert poker players often omit the outcome when seeking advice about their play. This became such a natural habit that I didn't realize until I started conducting poker seminars for players newer to the game, that this was not the norm for everyone. When I used hands I had played as illustrations, I would describe the hand up to the decision point I was discussing and no further, leaving off how the hand ended. This was, after all, how I had been trained by my poker group. When we finished the discussion, it was jarring to see a room full of people look at me like I had left them teetering on the edge of a cliff. Wait, how did the hand turn out? I gave them the red pill. It doesn't matter. Of course, we don't have to be describing a poker hand to use this strategy to promote disinterestedness. Anyone can provide the narrative only up to the point of the decision under consideration, leaving off the outcome so as not to infect their listeners with bias. And outcomes aren't the only problem. Beliefs are also contagious. If our listeners know what we believe to be true, they will likely work pretty hard to justify our beliefs, often without even knowing they are doing it. They will develop an ideological conflict of interest created by our informing our listeners of our beliefs. So when trying to vet some piece of information, some fact or opinion, we would do well to shield our listeners from what our opinion is as we seek the group's opinion. Simply put, the group is less likely to succumb to ideological conflicts of interest when they don't know what the interest is. That's McCoon and Perlmutter's point. Another way a group can debias members is to reward them for skill in debating opposing points of view and finding merit in opposing positions. When members of the group disagree, a debate may be of only marginal value because the people debating are biased toward confirming their position, often creating stalemate. If two people disagree, a referee can get them to each argue the other's position with the goal of being the best debater. This acts to shift the interest to open-mindedness to the opposing opinion rather than confirmation of their original position. They can't win the debate if they can't forcefully and credibly argue the other side. The key is for the group to have a charter that rewards objective consideration of alternative hypotheses so that winning the debate feels better than supporting the pre-existing position. The group's reinforcement ought to discourage us from creating a straw man argument when we're arguing against our beliefs and encourage us to feel good about winning the debate. This is one of the reasons it's good for a group to have at least three members, two to disagree and one to referee. What I've generally found is that two people whose positions on an issue are far apart will move toward the middle after a debate or skilled explanation of the opposing position. Engaging in this type of exchange creates an understanding of and appreciation for other points of view much deeper and more powerful than just listening to the other perspective. Ultimately, it gives us a deeper understanding of our own position. Once again, we are reminded of John Stuart Mill's assertion that this kind of open-mindedness is the only way to learn. Organized skepticism. Real skeptics make arguments and friends. Skepticism gets a bum rap because it tends to be associated with negative character traits. Someone who disagrees could be considered disagreeable. Someone who dissents may be creating dissension.